Welcome to the American Shakespeare Center's Blackfriars Backstage Pass, Pericles. Our discussion panel for this Backstage Pass are ASC Executive Director and Mary Baldwin College Shakespeare Professor Dr. Ralph Allen Cohen, along with ASC Renaissance Season actors Renee Thornton Jr., Greg Phelps, Miriam Donald, and Susan Hayward. We hope you enjoy this backstage look at the ASC's production of Pericles, currently appearing on the stage of the American Shakespeare Center's Blackfriars Playhouse in Stanton, Virginia.
This is Ralph Allen Cohen with the American Shakespeare Center, and our podcast today is going to be about Pericles, Shakespeare's and George Wilton's, we think, George Wilton's romance written in 1609. And I have with me the actors from the Actors' Renaissance Season, or four of them, to talk about the play. And they are, from my left...
Hi, I'm Renee Thornton Jr., and I play Pericles.
My name is Greg Phelps. I play a whole bunch of lords and messengers and a knight and Lysimachus.
My name is Miriam Donald. I play Thaisa and the Bawd.
My name is Susan Hayward. I play lots of characters, also a knight, and Marina.
Great. Okay, so any of you ever been in Pericles before?
Never. No.
That doesn't seem to be a very fruitful line of questioning. Have you seen productions before?
I have.
As have I.
Nope.
Nope.
Okay, so let's go to the two gentlemen, Renee and Greg, for $400. Can you tell me something about the productions you saw? I mean, what did you think? Did you like the show, not like the show?
I did. I've seen it three times before. One was just a workshop production of it, so there wasn't much to it. But one of the productions of it I saw was actually one of the most visually incredible productions of a play I've ever seen before.
Where was that?
At the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. Laird Williamson directed it, and it was just visually absolutely stunning.
And what about you, Greg?
I actually saw the Emlet production a couple of years ago. They performed it up here on the hill, and it was outside, and it was fascinating. I hadn't read it or seen it or heard anything about the plot or the characters or anything like that. I got kind of swept along in the story, and in their minimalistic style for that production, it helped to push that story along, to differentiate the different worlds that they go to, the different you know, countries and things.
Being in this production of it, having done, all of you have done a lot of Shakespeare, so this is a question I think everyone can answer, and that is, what's it feel like as a play compared to other plays you're in? What are the differences of the Shakespeare? How does it feel? Does it feel any different? I wonder, for you, for example, you have to age, but I'm talking now to Renee about Pericles, but are there any things you'd like to talk about?
The language does feel different. Particularly at the beginning of the play, I find that it's maybe not as well written as some of other Shakespeare's plays. So that's been sort of...
What strikes you? I'm going to follow that up.
Sure.
It's okay. What strikes you as lesser?
I don't find my language be particularly poetic or powerful, but I think it gets there. And by the last couple of scenes of the play, I think it's actually quite beautiful. But the stuff at the beginning feels really pragmatic and informative in a less than usually artful way.
Okay, I'm going to come back to you, because what I'd like you to be thinking about is sort of an example of the first and an example of the other, and I don't want to make you do it on the spot. But so you'll have it later on. I'll put you
all
on
right,
the spot about
okay.
it and be thinking about something really you love from the second half and something that you think is, well, this is just getting information across right here.
Sure.
So from the first half. Greg, you were going to, do you have anything to say about being in this as opposed to or the language or any differences?
Well, this one's very different from a lot of the Shakespeare shows that I've been in, or Shakespeare / you know, Wilson, whatever his name is.
And George, I think we call
George.
Him George.
George Porgy. Anyway, I play about seven characters in the show. And because the nature of the story is so epic, it travels to so many different places, a lot of my characters are, and can be, and will be, and are extremely different from one another, in terms of, you know, who they are, where they are, what kind of clothes they wear, things like that.
So there's a lot of changing for you.
A lot of changing, but it's there's such a broad spectrum of things, as opposed to maybe playing three or four characters in a show, but they're all in the same place. You know, they're all in the same area, country slash town.
Is that sort of give you more permission or less permission? Or, I mean, is there anything that, you know, how does that for you as an actor, knowing that, okay, I'm not, you know, I'm not a guy, another guy in Ephesus. I'm in a different part of the world now, so it's not like doubling that or tripling or quadrupling or whatever the word seven would be, and oopling.
Septupling. Sure.
Is there a difference for you there?
Yeah, I think so. I think it helps to differentiate the different characters, because if I was seven characters in this, in like one little area of the world or something like that, then it would be kind of hard to try to find different physical costume, voice, different things to differentiate the characters. But since I'm playing so many different characters from so many different places, it's so easy. You know, one character is dressed basically in John's Ariel costume from the production of The Tempest this last season, and some glasses, and that's a character. And then another one is you know, in a tabard and a headband and some armor, and another one, and it's just very, very different. So I think it's fun, first of all, to go to so many different places.
And let me remind the audience that the Actors Renaissance season, you guys direct the thing yourselves, and are really, that's not the word, put it together yourselves, yeah. I think is better to say, and you choose your own costumes and any of the things that you decide to do with them. Mm-hmm. So is there a choice you're particularly happy with? That you just think, you know, I'm really glad I went with that. That's been fun for me, or something maybe that you thought maybe be too outrageous and it isn't. It turned out it was just it fits and you like it a lot.
I like Lysimachus. I like how that turned out.
Describe it for the audience.
Sure. Well, first of all, let me say that because we didn't have a single director, I'm talking a lot, I'm sorry.
No, I hate talking. I'm so glad you are.
We didn't have a director for this, and we put it together ourselves, like you said. We sort of left it to the main characters of each section of each world, whether it's Ephesus or Mytilene or wherever it is, to sort of come up with the theme, to come up with what distinguishes that world from the other worlds. And then everybody else kind of fit themselves in around it. So for Mytilene, Miriam here and Chris play the Bawd and Pandar, and that's sort of where I took my cue from. And they had this strange combination of sort of Dickensian.
I say Sweeney Todd meets a whorehouse.
Yeah. And so that was a fun little world to find, you know, an upper status character in. Try to make sense of
that.
So
what did you do?
It's basically, I think I pulled some stock costumes from the Christmas Carol section. It's just really high collar and vest, and I actually had some tuxedo pants from a catering job that I did.
Yeah,
yes.
No. That was before we overpaid you.
So that kind of mix and match to try to put that together, it really differentiated from many. The costume helped with the physicality, helped with the character, helped with this and this and that, and it all kind of came together.
That's a great example. To turn to our Bawd, talk to us a little bit about your part as you know, a Bawd. Explain what you did with costume.
Well,
I think it's pretty.
I want to say first of all that I didn't memorize Pericles until late, and when I got cast, I saw that Thaisa was a princess, and that was probably my bigger role in the show, and so that's kind of just the scenes that I was looking at, and I thought, Bawd, it sounds like a smaller character role in somebody else's world, so I'm not going to really worry about that. And then I got my sides, and I thought, shite, I'm going to have to do some thinking about this, and
because, in fact, Bawd is a very large
part. Yeah. I had no idea. And I think when I just started memorizing it and referring to women as creatures, and you know, we're selling these creatures, and there's such a lack of respect for women as their product. And the first thing I say is, we have but 4-3, and they can do no more than they can do, and with continual action, they are even as good as rotten, which is just a disgusting image about women in a whorehouse. So, so I just started thinking about, you know, disgusting whorehousey images, and I thought about Sweeney Todd, and that was just kind of where I went. And so I went to the first rehearsal, which is kind of rare that people have costumes this early in the process, but I went to our first rehearsal of the Bawdy House in full costume and full makeup with my wig and all of these things. And
Why did you decide to do that?
Because I wanted to communicate to my fellow actors what I was thinking. And, you know, and that I had some strong ideas about what I wanted the world to look like and also be like. And also, I think that image informs movement, informs voice, informs relationships, like all of those things. And so as soon as they saw me, and it was like, oh, this is where we are, I guess this is where we're going.
Right, it's just a really Greg strong way of in the scene, and so here she comes in.
It's a strong way of communicating, yeah, kind of where what I was thinking about without saying, well, I'm thinking I was gonna have the, you know, well, why don't I just show up in my striped tights that are sagging around my ankles, you know, what does that tell you about where I am? So
you also have a cigar.
And I also have a cigar. Yes.
Well, why don't you light the cigar?
Because there's no smoking in the Blackfriars Playhouse.
Right? Even actors?
I don't know.
I don't think so.
If we were doing a, you know, for example, if we were doing crosswords and we needed to put out a cigarette
in a marked manner. I never even considered it.
Because it would be great, because suddenly we'd have an odor. The whole audience would have a sort of whorehouse odor.
And my mama would be so proud. I know. I didn't even consider it.
I was just curious.
Yeah. So
the cigar then functions basically, I would say, as a visual.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Not as an olfactor.
Yes. And I can use it in certain phallic ways.
So we could not say to Freud, in this case, Dr. Freud, the cigar is only a cigar. We couldn't say that. Okay.
Correcto. But I also absolutely love my Thaisa scenes with Pericles. I just think they're so fun. And that world is crazy. The Simonides and Thaisa are constantly, every other line is an aside to the audience with a different motivation than what we're saying to one another. And I just think it's hilarious.
It's just so much fun.
And a very, very different world than Mytilene, you know, than the Bawdy House and everything.
What were you
going
for with Thaisa? I'm just interested in how you saw her status-wise. I can tell you what I see later if you like, but it was a surprise to me.
Well, I think I have somewhat of a dorky father, but there's a lot of wealth in the city, and my lines are, all viands that I eat do seem unsavory, wishing him my meat. And then I turn to my father and say, sure, he's a gallant gentleman. You know, I think she's daddy's little girl that has certain desires, you know. And he does the same thing, you know. We're both high status, but very down to earth, I think. Down to earth majesty.
Well, what about those costumes? I mean, James wears a white suit with a vest and a wig. Zeppo or Harpo wig?
It's a curly blonde wig.
That I now wear as sight gag in the Bratz of Clarence.
Yes.
I wanted something very pastel-y, something very cheery, spring. I wanted bright colors. I wanted it to be a place where there was a lot of warmth and love and fun. And there's dancing and there's music and all of those things. So I just felt like, you know, the text informed that this world, if we're going to make them all different, this is the happy world. This is sunshine. This is springtime. This is love and warmth and, you know, so I wanted pastels and spring colors and such.
Susan, you play not only Marina, but you open the play as the daughter of Antiochus. Can you talk about that?
Well, my first reaction, one of the reviews that came out described that relationship as a consensual relationship between Antiochus and his daughter, full of incest. And that was not the case. And it's interesting that that didn't get communicated. The way Ben, the guy who's playing Antiochus, really conceived that world was a very militaristic world, a world where there are a lot of limits, a lot of rules. And I kind of see her as someone who's trapped in that relationship. And she doesn't really have a way to get out. And so I'm still kind of crunching over how to express that.
It's interesting to me that the play gives her two lines.
Only two.
Two lines, and that's...
Wishing you good luck, right?
Yeah. Wishing you good luck. And saying, you know, of all Sadiet, mayst thou prove prosperous. Of all Sadiet, I wish thee happiness. That's the only time she ever gets to speak. And in our production, it's after Antiochus has turned away. It's a private moment between the two of them. Otherwise, she has no voice and no will at all.
And your costuming there, describe it to the audience.
There's a line that says that she should come forth appareled like the spring and like a bride. So we went for all white. And it's kind of a white shift with lace on top. And I found this great long piece of lace that has these little beads of pearl, I guess, are in it. And so I've wrapped that around my neck and my head, kind of every girl's princess dream. And also there's a veil covering
That's what I wanted
my
to
face.
Talk about. So talk about the veil and what you were thinking of the veil.
Actually, Ben also suggested that as well. There's a lot of talk of her dressed as a bride, so I took some cues from that. And there's all this talk about how beautiful she is. The wealth of her beauty has tempted men from afar to come and try to win her. And I just personally, no woman can live up to that. So you hide it from the audience and let the audience kind of imagine this beautiful woman who also, in a completely darker way, has no say. So her mouth is covered, her face is covered.
That actually comes across. I mean, what you're saying about the incestuous relationship not being a two-way street or not being consensual, the little veil helps a lot in the sense that you're silenced. I mean, it's a nice thing. As does your line about it to Pericles, where you wish him success. You know, so you were really following Ben's sort of militaristic thing, but you're not obviously not dressed militaristically. You're dressed, as you say, as a bride. But how did it inform your movements?
Movement-wise, very sparse and simple. I also tried to do something. This is gonna probably sound not very progressive. Something very servant-like. She doesn't stomp around and make her presence known. It's straightforward. She kneels a lot. When the military men kind of corner Pericles, she kind of scoots out of the way like a servant, like someone who doesn't really own the space that she's in. And so I've tried to make her demure in that way.
Right. Well, you do. You succeed. Would you give me the line again? I'm sorry, I just didn't hear it the first time that you give him. Could you just do that line?
Of all Sadiet, mayst thou prove prosperous. Of all Sadiet, I wish thee happiness.
So, Pericles, you don't change too many people in this. Do you have any doubling? I'm trying to remember.
I don't. I only play Pericles, and that there's wouldn't really be the only section of the play that I'm not in is the bawd scene. So I suppose theoretically Pericles could play Pander, but other than that, there would be no other part that he could play. It's the Burbage break, the Act Four Burbage break. It's just
for our audience members. Assuming Richard Burbage played all the big parts, what you'll notice is that character, for example, Hamlet, basically seems to disappear in the fourth of five acts, or at least gets a long blow in the fourth of the five acts, and that happens with Pericles.
One of the things that I think is also very different about this play, I was talking with one of the other people in the cast the other day about who is the antagonist of this play. There is no villain quote unquote, per se. I mean, Antiochus is definitely presented as a villain and
escaped immediately, though.
Right, but is only in the first two scenes of the play, or the first scene of the play, and then never seen again, though spoken of much more than he's actually around. And so Pericles' journey isn't about his sort of trials against a person with a person. It's really about his trials with fate and with the gods, who he talks to a lot. But that's different, because that's usually not how these plays sort of operate. And because of that, it's a lonely role to play, because you don't have a partner or a companion, or, you know, you don't...
Horatio?
You don't have a Hamlet Horatio, or Othello Iago, or... you know, Violet or
Helicanus,
or Helicanus, but we only have a scene together at the beginning, and then I don't see him up in the play again until the end of the play. So, and he travels so much to all these other people's places. It's really, he is more a feather for each wind that blows than most of these.
Well, you bring up, I think, one of the things about the play that's so remarkable, which is how peripatetic it is. It's just everywhere. Mm-hmm. And you guys actually had been speaking to me earlier about it. People had said, you know, this is the fun thing about it, in a way, because it gives you these different worlds. And so if one of you sort of describes to the audience, we've done a little bit with the world of Lysimachus, the, what's the name of the?
Middling,
where you're...
The world of the bod.
That's right. the body work, and so you went with Sweeney Todd. Look, could one of you just step in and describe some of the other worlds?
Well, as we talked about as well with Antioch, it's a militaristic, lots of blacks and uniforms.
Tarsus is was, I would say, Kabuki inspired, but, you know, isn't Kabuki, but. That world was very affected by movement, a stylistic movement, and also that they were, that first scene in Tarsus, they're starving. So they just went with just sinking bodies in white and, you know, just we hardly had anything to feed ourselves, clothe ourselves. So that's that world.
Oh, and you already talked also about the world of
Pentapolis.
Pentapolis, which you being said, very spring and warm and...
Right, and circular movements, so, you know, just easy, light, fun.
And so in the process where you guys are working together, those words all get said,
mm-hmm.
you say, and then people kind of know what you mean, and they start working in those ways, and they pick their costumes in those ways. Is that how it happens?
Mm-hmm.
Sort of. I knew back... in the fall, when the casting came out, and was talking a lot with John Harrell, who plays Gower, about what to do with this play, because I think the fun element of this play, and also the challenging element of this play, if you're putting it together, is making it clear to the audience all these traveling that Pericles does, and all these different places you go to, and how. And so I'd said to John back then, I was like, I really feel like the solution to this is having whoever the sort of main person in each world is to define their world. So we talked about that the first day of rehearsal, and then people wrote up on the board words that they had, colors.
Seasons.
Yeah, seasons, movement ideas. And then people sort of piled that information together and went from there.
Well, I've seen, I don't know, I think this is my seventh maybe Pericles, so I haven't really seen that many, but... it really is the clearest. It's just incredibly clear where you are all the time. I mean, because of what you guys do. And of course, we don't have a set, you know. We just have that spare space, and you guys make it so clear.
We also only have a cast of 12, and so everyone really has to
work.
Hustle
yeah.
in order to make that, yeah.
that work.
Turn out.
Yeah. So it's just a wonderful, it's great fun from an audience member's point of view. It's just a lovely sense of something really different. Because I think one of the things that Shakespeare does so well and in his other plays is to create a sort of central feeling to the world. I mean, things, you know, he'll sometimes he'll cut a world into, like Rome and Egypt, in Antony and Cleopatra. But normally speaking, you can almost talk about a temperature for a room. I used to do something with my students where I'd have them say the temperature of a play. You know, where they couldn't talk to each other. They would just write down the temperature of the play. What's the daily temperature? And it was remarkable how much the, you know, within 2 or 3, 4 degrees of one another they all be, because there is a sort of sense at every play. But this play really does have different temperatures in different places. And
it's interesting that you brought that up, because at one point Miriam was talking, she's like, we don't have a winter. None of these places are winter. And it was interesting because none of them really
are
winter. Like, none of them felt like they could winter.
Because the slowness of the, and I'm forgetting,
Tarsus?
Tarsus. The slowness of the Tarsus scenes, the famine and everything, the sense is not of winter, but of a summer.
Of the desert.
Yeah.
A desert thing. Yeah. And but not a winter thing. So, yeah, it's really something.
But in looking at seven different worlds, it's true. I was like, we have no fur. Where's the fur world? Nobody's in fur. I don't understand. They're all going to look the same.
It really gave us, I think, permission, too, to just make really bold choices costuming-wise. And like Miriam's bod or the Tarsus, it's all white, and then we have this prop that it brings color and a certain makes us move, I think, certain ways. So I think...
Which prop?
Of the fans.
Of the fans, yes. The fans, which one of them's red.
One of them is red, right. So I think those kind of choices made us be really, really specific in how they informed us of each different world.
Of each play. Can I come back to you now? Have you had time to think about... Renee. I come back to Renee.
I wasn't really able to think of a specific line, more like a section. I have a soliloquy at the top of Act 1, Scene 2, where I explain why I fled from Antioch and the current state of my situation in Tyre, and how I don't know what I'm going to do. Then Helicanus comes on stage, and I repeat to him almost the exact same speech. And I'm like, this is not good. There's not any
new information.
The audience just heard it, so they certainly don't need to hear it again. So I don't understand the place of the soliloquy. I understand why Helicanus needs the information. I understand why the audience needs the information. I'm not sure I quite understand why the audience needs it twice. But then by the time, I mean, one of my favorite lines in the play is in the scene I have with Marina, the 12th night discovery scene.
Explain why we're saying that, because you're right. And I mean, would you help with the audience with that?
Because to me the scene in Twelfth Night is just so fantastic. It's a series of questions
at the end of that play. Sebastian and her and Viola, who are twins, see each other. They should know right away who they are, and they do this kind of interrogation.
Right.
I had a father, and he had this, and I had this. I had a father, and I had a sister who had this, and they keep going on and on, as though they can't take in. And in this play, over the years.
So in the play of Pericles, the same thing happens. Pericles, who thinks that Marina is dead, meets this girl who looks like what his daughter might look like if we had magically aged 14 years. So they ask a series of questions, and he finds it hard, impossible to believe, and she has no idea who he is, and so they're going through the thing. And at one point, she mentions her nurse, Lycorida, who he knows that would be her nurse, and he says, "This is the rarest dream that e'er dull sleep did mock sad fools withal." And I just think that's a beautiful line that really...
That's a good one.
...really describes the magic of the situation. What I think is also interesting about the end of this play is you not only have the Twelfth Night scene, but then you're going to have the end of Winter's Tale as well because his wife, Thaisa, who he also thinks is dead, is there at the end of the play. So we have reconciliation with wife and with daughter, which makes the play have maybe one or two more endings than it needs.
But I've watched, and I want to talk. I would like to talk for just a minute about your audiences. Tell me about what it. You know, talk a little bit about audience response to that play so far. I know you've done it, what, three times before?
Three times. And it's been fantastic.
Yeah.
The audiences have really enjoyed it.
What I noticed was that not only did they really enjoy it, but for those two scenes that you're talking about, they wept.
Yeah.
I mean, they really wept. And which is pretty interesting because, of course, right before they're weeping, you guys are, but I can't remember your last... Your last interlude song. I mean, what is there?
Oh, Tide is High.
Huh?
Tide is High.
Blondie. Yeah, Tide is High. Yeah. So everybody's having a nice time. Tide is High. And then suddenly, people are crying. If it'd be all right, since we have you here, could we do the recognition scene and I'll just say to the audience, listen to the ways in which it wouldn't take, you would know, anybody would know. You know, some of this evidence, almost any of this evidence, that she found her father and the father had found her.
Where do you live?
Where I am but a stranger. From the deck you may discern the place.
Oh, where were you bred?
If I were to tell my history, it would seem like lies disdained in the reporting.
Prithee, speak on. I will believe thee, and make my senses credit thy relation to points that seem impossible. For thou look'st like someone I loved indeed. What were thy friends? How lost thou them? Thy name, my most kind virgin. Recount, I do beseech thee. Come, sit by me.
My name is Marina.
Oh, I am mocked, and thou by some insensate god sent hither to make the world to laugh at me.
Patience, good sir, or here I'll cease.
Nay, I'll be patient. Thou little knowest how thou dost startle me to call thyself Marina.
The name was given me by one who had some power, my father and a king.
How? A king's daughter, and called Marina.
You said you would believe me, but not to be a troubler of your peace, I'll end here.
But are you flesh and blood? Motion as well? Have you a working pulse and are no fairy? Prithee, speak on. Where were you born and wherefore called Marina?
Called Marina, for I was born at sea.
At sea? What mother?
My mother was daughter to a king, who died the minute I was born, as my good nurse Lycorda hath oft delivered, weeping.
Oh, stop there a little. This is the rarest dream that e'er dull sleep did mock sad fools withal. This cannot be my daughter buried.
Great, we'll stop there. I just want to point out, you meet someone who's of the right age, and her name's Marina. Well, okay, and you get angry because somebody's making fun of me here since right. My daughter's name was Marina, and anybody could know that who worked for you, fine. And my father was a king. Oh, okay, wait. So let's say we've now lowered the list from all the Marinas in the world to all the Marinas who are daughters of kings in the world. And she was born at sea. Oh, all the princesses named Marina in the world who were born at sea. Now, I guess you could argue that if you were born at sea, it would be natural to think of being called Marina. But, you know, but it turns out that your mother was also daughter to a king. And it takes the name of Lycorda, as I said, Lycorda, to sort of cinch it. And actually, there's another moment, too, isn't there? There's one more thing that...
There's more questions, but what I like about it, he even says at one point, what was thy mother's name? For truths can never be confirmed enough, though doubts did ever sleep.
And that's it. Mm-hmm. And that little thing he just said, truths can never be confirmed enough. There are so many that I think of as you like it. And I think of when Rosalind is questioning Celia about who put the stuff up on the trees. And Celia tells him at the very beginning that it's a guy who gave her a necklace, that she gave a necklace to. You know, she's only given one necklace. And she spins the next column of a two-column text saying, who, and being told everything she needs to be told. And I do think it's about the way that great news, and you have the line, mm-hmm. to about everything's been worth it, you know, all the pain and everything, and at this moment, you know, it's just this great.
So. I say it after the Thaisa recognition, I say, no more, you gods, your present kindness make my past miseries sports.
What's funny about that last scene, the last recognition scene, is that Pericles is talking, and I get up, and I say, you are, there's no questioning, you are, oh, royal Pericles, and I faint, of course, but it's overwhelming, but there's no question and answer, you know, there's,
yeah,
there it is.
That fits,
he
really.
Talks, we're not, let's cut to the chase, you are, you are,
which is oh, royal like, Pericles. It's funny because you chose what you and James chose as your Simonides and Thaisa as your kind of to the point person, you know, it comes out there in a nice moment, except it was a little too much even for you, and down you go.
That's well, and we've made a great moment because the recognitions at that point then start to get a little much, and Helicanus comes into the picture, and I just love how Miriam, you know, Helicanus is like,
royal queen.
And you have this great, yeah. Do it.
I know you not.
And the audience loves it, and it's a great laugh, and it's a great release, and it's an acknowledgement that, come on.
Exactly. Yeah, actually, he does something like this in Cymbeline at the end, where everybody's like, oh yeah, you're my cousin so-and-so, and you're my cousin
right.
so-and-so.
Yes.
It's great. And here he does, I think, make fun of it. I mean, I think the writer here is Shakespeare, and I think Shakespeare goes, I don't know you. You know, it's a great moment, and yeah, it's very funny. I have one more question that I'd like to get straight on because the production's really left me ambivalent about it. The name of the governor of Mytilene is...
It's Lysimachus.
Of course.
Lysimachus. I just like to say
it's
it
a
that
great,
way.
It's a great bit with Lysimachus and Lysimachus.
Lysimachus. Well, you know, I liked saying Lysimachus, and I kind of chose as the bod to say certain things differently.
Different.
Like virginal.
Virginal
fencing. Fabulous.
Virginal is scans, right?
I don't think so.
Yeah, it
no.
It?
Well, it's all prose, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's scans anyway.
Pray you, without any more of your virginal fencing, will you
more
use him kindly?
Vaginal fencing.
Virginal fencing. And I liked saying Lysimachus. And Renee was like, it's Lysimachus. I'm afraid people are going to get confused. And I was like, fine. So then we put a little bit into it. Here comes the Lord Lysimachus. Lysimachus. Lysimachus.
Lysimachus. That's great.
I'm so proud of the way our actors hew close to the text. Thank you so much, guys, for today
and
sharing with us, and for a great show. And so let me do the obvious thing and promote, but I kind of deadly on, I mean, I want to really say, you're going to come see the show. You're going to have a great time with wonderful interludes, and it's just fun. Audiences are eating it up, and you will too. So thanks, everyone. And
thanks, Ralph.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We hope you have enjoyed this Blackfriars Backstage Pass. You can download these programs for free at AmericanShakespeareCenter.blogspot.com or subscribe to all of the ASC's podcasts through the iTunes Music Store podcast directory or through any number of other podcast listing sites. Pericles will be performed at the ASC's Blackfriars Playhouse in Stanton, Virginia, in repertory with the first quarto Hamlet, John Webster's The Duchess of Malfi, Ben Jonson's The Devil is an Ass, and Paul Menzer's The Brats of Clarence through March 25th. Tickets for all five Renaissance season productions are available by calling the American Shakespeare Center box office toll-free at 1-877-MUCH-ADO or by going online at AmericanShakespeareCenter.com. I'm your Backstage Pass producer, Bill Gordon. Special thanks to recording engineer Sam Kugler. Once again, thank you for joining us, and we'll look forward to seeing you at the Blackfriars Playhouse.